This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. Outside Baton Rouge, and if you're in the city limits, you can dial 297-5633 or send us an email to talk at talklouisiana.org. We start with Quinn Hillier and Roy Fletcher. Quinn is a noted conservative, now nationally recognized for his work as a commentator and columnist, and Roy Fletcher, of course, is a veteran political consultant who's handled campaigns near and far, and in 2000, he was on the front lines of the campaign of John McCain for the White House, and McCain came up short, ran a gallant race against George Bush, but lost the nomination to the 42nd American president. And what happened next? It was John McCain as a major stalwart in the Senate from then till now, and he died Saturday, 4 days short of his 82nd birthday, and today is the 13th anniversary of Katrina. It would have been the 82nd birthday for John McCain. The funeral services are Saturday in Washington. There will be services in Arizona preceding that. Notably absent will be the President of the United States, Donald Trump. Roy Fletcher, you will be at the services in Washington. What's your take on the remembrance and the legacy of John McCain?
He was one of my heroes late in life. I really liked the man. He was tough and he had a temper and all of that, but he was fun to work with, and he was a man that did not suffer fools very easily.
Not at all.
Quinn,
in his eloquent way, has written a remembrance of John McCain, and he, of course, compares him to Ronald Reagan, and John McCain is a man who, as we know, spent 5.5 years in a prison camp in Hanoi, the so-called Hanoi Hilton. He was truly a hero, although the President of the United States said he was not, because he was, quote, captured. As a result, that feud evolved, and the President also called McCain a loser. He was anything but a loser, wasn't he, Quinn Hillier?
John McCain was a winner. John McCain was an American hero, not just because he endured horrible captivity, although the way that he did it certainly added to his heroism, but also because of how he served his country in every way that he could, and because of the principles that he served and that he devoted himself to, including the idea that America is the light of the world, that freedom is the central theme, and that we do have a duty to try within our means to help others achieve freedom as well. And when freedom is your watchword and you devote yourself to it and you suffer for it and you serve for it, that makes you a hero in my book.
What do you make of Joe Biden being chosen to be one of the speakers at the farewell for John McCain, and yet the president was asked not to attend by the senator himself?
I think that's perfectly fine. Look, Joe Biden's son died of the exact same brain cancer that took McCain. When McCain was diagnosed, Biden, by all accounts, went way out of his way to try to help McCain find the best doctors that he could, you know, bring to bear the experiences he had with his own son, in case there was something that he had learned that could help McCain get through it. He acted as a real friend to McCain, and that was one of the great things about John McCain. Is political differences aside, he could still have friendships. We need to learn that again, how to have friendships across the aisle, and more power to him.
877-217-5757 is your number, and before we go to the phone lines, Roy Fletcher knew John McCain as a man, in addition to being a candidate, and he was a tough guy to work for, according to some. People who worked for him generally have positive things to say about him, but he was a guy who let you know what he thought.
What you find with him is that the notion that he's a tough guy to work for, but most of the people that work for him for a long time. So that sort of undercuts that notion. As Rick Davis said about me, I had I was fired the quickest and reinstated the fastest in the history of John McCain.
Who was?
I was.
You were?
Yeah, during the campaign.
Why were you fired?
A couple of us got together and did a piece on George Bush in New Hampshire. And it was a comparison. McCain had said he wasn't going to run anything negative. Well, he saw it as negative. We didn't see it as negative, given our nature. And apparently got out to the press. And so he told the press, I'm fired. Whoever did that, I'm fired. Well, I got a call about 20 minutes later going, that's all bogus. Don't worry about it.
So you were back.
I was back.
That was a brutal campaign, and the Bushes did some things that were over the line, according to some, but yet George Bush will apparently be at the...
Yes. He's supposed to speak in Washington.
All right. 877-217-5757. Chuck and Scott. Chuck, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with Quinn Hillier and with Roy Fletcher. Hi, Chuck.
Good morning. I have a question. You know, on Facebook, I see the Trump supporters, and most of them are McCain haters. They cite the Nixon pardon that never happened. They cite charges that were never made. And then they cite POWs who were supposedly with John McCain during his 5.5 years. And all the POWs I've seen on CNN and Fox News even, you know, extol John McCain as an upright human being and a leader throughout the whole POW experience. How do we combat these haters?
All right. Quinn, what do you make of some of those who have actually attacked McCain's war record, including the president, who didn't have one of his own? That seems to be beyond the pale.
It is beyond the pale. And look, there is a cottage industry of, you want to talk about fake news, this is really fake news, of accounts out there that have been thoroughly debunked, saying that somehow McCain was responsible for starting the terrible fire on the deck of the Forrestal. No, he wasn't. In fact, he was very heroic in saving people once the fire started, and he had nothing to do with starting it. Saying that somehow he collaborated with the North Vietnamese to get special treatment, that has been totally, utterly debunked. And again and again and again, you see this cottage industry of fake news about McCain. It's despicable. It's dishonest. And we really need to get beyond that and see this is a man who had a chance to get early release and escape all that torture because of who his father was, and instead he turned it down. He said, you're not letting me go unless you let these other guys go. And he was tortured for it, and he stood it like a man, and then he came out after that and spent the next 45 years serving his country. God.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with Roy and Quinn. Hi, Phil.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, gentlemen. You know, I was looking at some political documentaries, Imagine That. Interestingly enough, Mr. John McCain got him touch with Russ Feingold in 1990 to see about working across the aisle to take big money out of politics. And the Feingold-McCain bill did that or was trying to do that. I mean, he said that big money was corrupting our democracy, and he's right.
Well, the Citizens United case changed that a great deal, but John McCain, who had been embroiled in a controversy of his own. He was one of the Keating Five, Roy Fletcher. He came back with a vengeance from that setback.
Yeah. You know, I think that point that Quinn made, during 2000, the press, there was a lot of fluff up about members of the Senate talking behind McCain's back about it. Some, anyway, that he was crazy, that his war record, and so on and so forth. And so we ended up having to release almost all of the medical records and of McCain from the period of time that he served there. That was bunk. But the truth is that what Quinn said about all of that cottage industry out there is absolutely true. And it's not only on the right; it's on the left too. I mean, I was reading Twitter the other night. It was vicious. Vicious.
Hey, okay, 877-217-5757. More with Quinn Hillier and Roy Fletcher after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. 877-217-5757. We'll cover some more ground with Quinn Hillier and Roy Fletcher, two card-carrying conservatives, but they have differing opinions on the current president of the United States, who will not be at John McCain's funeral service at the National Cathedral this Saturday. Roy Fletcher, who worked for Senator McCain, was invited and will attend, as will George W. Bush and Barack Obama. President Trump, a.k.a. David Dennison, will not be there. 877-217-5757 is your number. And there was a long simmering feud with the senator and the president, and many conservatives, Quinn, hold it against John McCain because he is the vote. He is the vote that kept Obamacare the law of the land. Is that a legacy that you think will be a good one or a bad one for John McCain?
It will be a mixed one, but context is appropriate there. A lot of the same conservatives furious with McCain for casting that vote are the same ones that were cheering on Jim Jordan and the congressman from Ohio and now want Jim Jordan for speaker. They were cheering him on when he torpedoed a much better, much more comprehensive bill to repeal Obamacare, when the momentum really, really mattered, and he was holding out for a bunch of tiny little tweaks in it, and literally killed the first version of the bill because it wasn't perfect, and they cheered him on. And then when McCain got there and had a much weaker bill, barely a bill at all, it was a sham of a bill, just barely to keep something alive, they were furious at him for killing a much worse bill than the bill that they had cheered Jordan on for killing. That's hypocrisy. And if you look, if you consider the context of what McCain said in his speech, just to think it was 2 days earlier, about the importance of getting it right and of doing things the right way and of working across the aisle, and you look at the whole arc of McCain's entire service, you see that what he did was very consistent with how he had believed and behaved his entire life. I give him a pass on it.
Roy, do you give him a pass?
I think Senator Kennedy explained that the other day pretty well. I saw him on TV. And McCain's problem with all that was the process by which it was written and passed. That's a fact. The problem with it is that show occurred and got repeated 8 jillion times, and it did not help him with the base of the party. There's no question about it. His legacy, whatever the case you want to call it, there's no question about that. It became a symbolic act. And that's the way people viewed it. On the other hand, I give him a pass on it for exactly what Quinn said, although the Jim Jordan thing I don't care about. But I think that the bill could probably have been written in a much more collegial sort of way to get to where we wanted to be.
All right, Steve.
It was also a bad bill. It was just a bad bill. It was a sham just created to pass something back to a conference committee hoping somebody else could salvage it.
That's correct. That's no question about it.
Pitiful little bill. It was pathetic.
Steve Wynnum, the former budget director for the great state of Louisiana, writes, he says, as I have watched tributes to John McCain in recent days, I've had to ask myself, how can the president's supporters not see the contrast between who Donald Trump is and the life John McCain lived and the person he was? Quinn, is that fair?
I think it's fair, but you know what? I don't even want to. I don't want to mention anything about the president and McCain right now. This is a week when we should be focusing on what is good about McCain. Let's set the feud aside. Let's not poison it. John McCain served his country for 60 years, and we don't need to poison the memory with all of this.
Roy?
I'd like to take a pass on that, but I won't. Look, I mean, you have two people that live different lives, different lifestyles, and there is no question in my mind that what John McCain did was extraordinary. Now, it was also extraordinary what a lot of other people did in war and what they suffered too. And they had problems as insurmountable sometimes personally as Trump. So I don't think that, you know, this is a place for angels. It's a place to remember John McCain's contribution and the kind of man he was. And he would tell you in a second, I was a human being. I had frailties. I had faults. I made mistakes all along the way. Mm-hmm. And whether they are Donald Trump's mistakes and frailties and faults, I'm not getting into that. But everybody has that. That's not even a comparison that needs to be.
All right. Well, the comparison that many make is that John McCain fought. His son of an admiral, grandson of an admiral. President Trump didn't. But as Americans, in 1992, we elected a draft dodger over a war hero in Bill Clinton and George Bush. 4 years later, we reelected Clinton over another war hero, Bob Dole. 4 years after that, we elected George Bush over a guy who served in Vietnam, Albert Gore. 4 years later, we elected George Bush again over a war hero, John Kerry. And 4 years later, we elected Barack Obama over a war hero, John McCain. So as Americans, we give lip service to military might being a prerequisite to be president, but ultimately we come down to voting for whomever we want. Now, President Trump, who levied extraordinary public attacks on Attorney General Jeff Sessions in recent weeks, according to the Washington Post, Quinn Hillier, has privately revived the idea of firing him in conversations with aides and personal lawyers this month, according to three people who are mentioned in the Washington Post story that is on the newsstands today. What happens if the president fires the attorney general? Will there be hell to pay, as Lindsey Graham said a few months ago?
There should be hell to pay, but now, typical Lindsey Graham, he is now saying that, well, he thinks that it makes sense for Sessions to go because the president needs to have an attorney general that he can work with well. So, you know, Lindsey Graham has done a typical Lindsey Graham, backtrack, siding with whoever's the strong man of the moment. I do think there will be some backlash, but I also think there's a lot of gutlessness out there, and that if this good man, this man of honor and integrity, Jeff Sessions, is fired, I think that a lot of people will be afraid to cross Trump, and there won't be enough of a backlash, at least among Republicans in the Senate, and things will just go along. And now, from the media, yeah, there'll be a backlash, and from the right, I'll be leading it.
Roy, you're a lawyer. Is Sessions toast?
I think he's toast, and I think that the question becomes not whether, in terms of the backlash and so on and so forth, is that if they are smart, if they want to fire him, they fire him and announce somebody immediately thereafter or that day. I think there are people out there that could fill that void and do the job. I mean, I got my own candidate for it. I think Quinn had, works or has written with him, Andrew McCarthy. I think that McCarthy would be a great U.S. Attorney General. But it has to be somebody that is strong enough themselves that people will feel safe to say they can withstand any kind of effort to punch them around, and at the same time can get to the bottom of some of these charges and serious charges now that affect DOJ and the FBI.
877-217-5757. We'll take a short news break and then return with Quinn Hillier, who is a New Orleans native, part of the David Treen, Bob Livingston wing of the Republican Party in its infancy in Louisiana, and Roy Fletcher, who was part of the Mike Foster wing of the Republican Party. He got him elected in 1995. 877-217-5757. Now the news with Karen Henderson on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Roy Fletcher, who handled John McCain's 2000 campaign for president, and Quinn Hillier, who has a long history in politics and in commentary as a conservative voice of note. He's now in Mobile after spending many years in New Orleans, his hometown, and he ran for Congress a few years ago. And last night, by the way, was an election night, and I've had a few listeners that talk at talklouisiana.org. They have asked Roy and Quinn to comment about what happened in Florida last night. Andrew Gillum, an African-American, won the Democratic primary in the governor's race. And Roy Fletcher, that is a state that has a major Senate race between Rick Scott and Bill Nelson. And this obviously, this governor's race is going to have some major impact on the Senate race.
It can cut both ways. Gillum will help Nelson get out the base of the Democratic Party. Whether it helps him enough is a question. The problem with Gillum is that he's not a centrist Democrat. He comes from the Democratic Socialist side of the party.
Progressive.
Whatever you want to call it. And the truth is that all he does is sort of amplify the problem with the National Democratic Party in the state of Florida. That's what he does, and it's going to make it tougher. I think it goes as a somewhat of a negative for Bill Nelson's campaign to with him with him as the gubernatorial candidate.
Quinn, how do you see it?
I see it exactly as Roy does. I think that this becomes a third straight election where Rick Scott wins by the skin of his teeth, but he is both a very tough, I don't want to say vicious, but a very tough campaigner, and he also tends to find ways to be lucky. Getting Gillum as an opponent does, because Gillum is so liberal, leftist, does rile up the base. Does rile up the reaction against him among centrist Floridians. Rick Scott will win.
All right, Tracy, and at the Capitol, following up on a discussion we had yesterday on this show, notes that if John Neely Kennedy runs for governor, he's got to announce he's going to run before he can win. But if he wins, that means in Louisiana in the year of 2020, just two short years away, that Roy Fletcher will have heaven for political consultants with two U.S. Senate elections at the same time. Roy Fletcher, are you salivating at that prospect?
Salivate. Yeah, it's salivating. My goodness, yes. Absolutely. I'm so glad she pointed that out.
Yeah.
Well, just a big platter.
And it could happen.
It could happen. It definitely could happen. And I would bet that it might. Let's put it this way. I would bet that we might have a Kennedy running for governor.
And you worked for John Kennedy.
I did a long time.
Know that he plays this Hamlet act real well.
He does.
And he's blocking any Republican from getting in the race.
He's absolutely got the arteries all blocked up. And Yeah, ambition is backing up, and people are getting antsy, and Jeff Landry's out there trying to break out the knives to get, to do some surgery on that heart. But it's not going nowhere, Jeff. It's until Kennedy decides what he wants to do.
And John Bel Edwards, Quinn, I think he won because of his opponent in 2015 in David Vitter. And it was not a close race. He won 56-44%. Even Kerry Jefferson Parish, your old stomping ground. Believe that Democrat carried, and he carried Livingston Parish too.
Absolutely.
which
is amazing.
Really, a parish that Donald Trump got 85% of the votes in.
Right.
That will not happen this time. But can a Republican, someone like John Kennedy, close 12 points and win the election? You still watch Louisiana. What do you think about the governor's vulnerability? And by the way, on this show, on his show, he said that he has been actively recruited by the Republicans to switch parties. And I think that comes from the highest man in the country, the president, but he says he's not going to do it. But as a Democrat, how vulnerable is he, Quinn Hillier?
I think John Bel Edwards is definitely vulnerable. I think he's maintained a surprising level of popularity for a Democrat, but it's a conservative state. And he is a tax hiker. John Kennedy is popular. Roy Fletcher knows this better than I do. He's a better prognosticator in Louisiana now than I am. But I think Edwards is definitely vulnerable.
I don't believe that, Quinn.
You what?
I don't believe that I'm a better prognosticator.
But Kennedy, he lost to Mary Landrieu.
Yeah.
He's not an invincible
Absolutely not. Nobody's invincible in this environment, for God's sakes. I mean, but first, though, Jim, you make a really good point, and that is he's got to run. And until he's in, he's not in. And that's just the way it is. He's got to decide what he wants to do. He thinks he has time to do that because of his numbers. He may be right, but at some point, he's creating maybe, perhaps at some point, he starts creating a crowded field. That's not good for anybody.
And the election, by the way, is a year, a month, and a half away. So 13 and a half months from the election.
You are data knowledge.
Well, I think it would be appropriate in our remaining time with the two of you to remember what happened on this date in 2005. With Hurricane Katrina, and 13 years have passed. Quinn Hillier, that was a searing experience, and the state, of course, was changed dramatically by it.
Yeah, and just one of the worst things I've ever seen. I don't have to tell your listeners that. It is, though, to me, remarkable how well Louisiana, New Orleans, and the Mississippi Gulf Coast have recovered from it. New Orleans is in many ways better than it's been in decades. Still has problems, but better than it's been in decades in a lot of ways. A real testament to the spirit of New Orleanians and Louisianans that they brought their city and their region, their state back so well.
Roy, you were here in 2005. In fact, I remember doing this show on that date, and you know who my first guest was?
Who?
Bobby Jindal.
Bobby Jindal.
Congressman Bobby Jindal. We didn't know at that time, though.
Yeah.
The levees had not broken. That
yeah,
this
right.
was going
it
to
was,
be
it was
cataclysmic
a little
event
yeah,
it was.
Right, right.
But it finished Kathleen Blanco.
Finished her.
And it made Bobby Jindal the governor of Louisiana.
Well, it built a lot of buyer's remorse. People started looking at it in terms of buyer's remorse about the choice they had made. What I remember most about it was that I went to LSU and was a volunteer for a few days. All I can tell you is after about 3 days, I had to go home. I was so depressed. I mean, that was a very, very searing event to me. And my hat off to all those people that worked out there and just kept working. I couldn't do it. It was just unbelievable what I saw and what I experienced.
And Quinn, you're like me, you were much younger. In fact, I think you were probably a year old when Hurricane Betsy came through New Orleans. And that was a much stronger hurricane. The levees didn't break, but I still don't know, and I hope we don't have to find out, if New Orleans can withstand a Category 4 or 5 hurricane. Let's hope that we don't have to repeat this at some point in our lives.
That's my engineering friends tell me that that the levees are still not built well enough to handle something like a Betsy or a Camille. That is very worrisome to me. So yeah, I'm very worried about it. And let's change the subject real quick. Again, happy 82nd birthday to the late Senator John McCain today.
He was one of a kind,
one of a kind, a
maverick. And will they name the Senate office building in his honor, Roy Fletcher?
I think so. I think the Republicans are just they're missing a real chance here. They could make a real statement with this. But I don't know that they will. I don't know that they will.
Well, and the president very reluctantly finally gave his condolences to Senator McCain and talked about his loss, but it took a while. It took a lot of prodding.
They were two bulls. That's what they were, and they didn't like each other, and that's just the bottom line.
But here, McCain, and you were on.
But I think the president.
You were on the front lines of the campaign. McCain was accused by the Bush campaign of fathering an illegitimate child.
Every calumny you can imagine.
And he sucked it up
and kept going
and endorsed the man for president.
Absolutely.
Well, let me jump in here. He wasn't really accused by the Bush campaign. There were.
That's fair. I will take.
There were some subcontractors in South Carolina. Who were they were sort of high up subcontractors for the Bush campaign.
Name Rove, maybe Rove, Carl Rove.
No. Rove had nothing to do with it. This was
holding his head.
This was a fairly well known operative in South Carolina.
Warren Tompkins, I know who it was.
Exactly, and it didn't come from the Bush campaign. The Bush campaign's fault was that when it came out, they should have quashed it, and they spent several days sort of twiddling their thumbs, letting it go out there rather than quashing it.
Quinn, it was more than a several. And trust me when I tell you that, if it didn't have anything to do with the Bush campaign, then I'm going to go take a barrel of cocaine. That's just the way I feel about it.
And if McCain wins South Carolina, he's the president.
He's going to be the president of the United States. And it was, and they, everybody knew what was on the line.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. It's always a pleasure. Quinn Hillier, thank you.
Thank you, Quinn.
And thank you, Roy Fletcher. We'll be back with Ian McDougall of ProPublica on what's going on in the beautiful hamlet of Ville Platte. He's painting a not-so-pretty picture. We'll talk about it after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number, and we're joined now by Ian McDougall of ProPublica, and he has written a piece about Ville Platte, beautiful city in Evangeline Parish, population 7,400, and according to Ian McDougall, a place where law enforcement is doing some things that is certainly worthy of scrutiny. And good morning to you, Mr. McDougall, based in the great city of New York.
Jim, thanks so much for having me.
It's nice to talk with you. What have you unearthed about what's going on in Ville Platte?
So it really is a question that goes back a little ways. For a long time, the police and the sheriff's office in Ville Platte had a sort of unwritten policy of what they called investigative holds, which was they believed that they could hold, detain someone, arrest them, put them in jail for up to 72 hours. They would actually do it sometimes for much longer without any basis for arresting them, which is unconstitutional. The Justice Department went in, and there was also separate criminal scrutiny from the FBI and others, and that ultimately led them to end that sort of unwritten policy, but they have since shifted to, I guess you could say, sort of underground investigative holds, holding people for up to a day. This is in particular the police department now, but without any basis. This includes people who are potential witnesses to crimes, people who they want to provide information as informants. So although the sort of particulars have changed, the general approach to law enforcement has not.
Ian McDougall is with us, a reporter for ProPublica who's reported about Ville Platte. He finds in his story that from 2012 to 2014, 700 people were, quote, unlawfully held at the jail in Ville Platte, close to one-tenth of the town's residents. You say for no reason, no reason that would make sense, but why, obviously it makes sense to the law enforcement people. Why have they said they have apprehended and detained these people?
Well, I think what they said to the Justice Department about that, sort of the multi-day detentions, is, and on some level this is true, it's you know, the ability to get people to cooperate with you is heightened when there's the threat of spending some time in a jail cell. So in that sense, it can make it appear that this technique or tool makes law enforcement easier. In point of fact, as the Justice Department's report pointed out, but also people told me when I was there, you know, you may get people to talk to you, but they may tell you what you want to hear as opposed to the truth.
Now, this is a report that is largely from 2012 to 2014. Do you have any indication if things are getting any better?
I think what has changed since federal scrutiny starting in about 2014-15, and I should say state law enforcement scrutiny, is that there is a less overt policy of doing this. People are not left in jail cells, as far as I can tell, for days anymore. But what's happened essentially is that the police department in particular has taken steps to still use these kinds of illegal detentions, but to make them, they don't document them in the way that they used to. They sort of keep them hidden and harder for investigators from the federal government or the state government to detect by avoiding, you know, having booking sheets on anybody, by detaining people in the break room for a day at a time where there's a security camera, but it doesn't work. So those sorts of techniques have sort of replaced the things they'd been doing for decades before.
Now, you say that Attorney General Jeff Sessions gutted some Justice Department reforms that affected Ville Platte. What happened based on your investigation pertaining to the Attorney General?
So the Justice Department released its report in December 2016, and the plan had been, and among staff attorneys in the Civil Rights Division, continued to be to put in place what's called a consent decree that it really means an agreement to institute a set of reforms that's backed up by the power of a federal judge. So if the police department isn't complying, the Justice Department can go to the judge and say, you need to take steps to force them to remedy the situation. What ended up happening, Jeff Sessions has been very open, the Attorney General has been very open about his dislike for consent decrees. He thinks they intrude on state and local control of their own affairs, and he believes they sort of denigrate law enforcement unfairly. And so under him, although the staff attorneys continued to try to move things forward as they had planned to, they essentially basically delayed the process for about a year, and then ultimately this past June issued what many folks who've worked in this area say are quite weak settlement agreements without the backing of a federal judge.
Now, listeners state something that I believe is in your report, Ian, that in 2016, the Obama Justice Department issued a report on two cities where they pointed out significant problems. One was Chicago and the other was Ville Platte?
Yes. So towards the end of the Obama administration, there were really three. Baltimore was the other one. Baltimore and Chicago both had much broader array of problems. Ville Platte was sort of a more precise problem that the Justice Department under Obama had been hoping to sort of use as a way of showing not just the law enforcement in Ville Platte how to stop doing this, but also showing police departments across the country, because this is a problem that comes up in other places, how to sort of move away from that practice and how communities can help their police departments move away from it. Chicago and Baltimore are much more complicated. And in Chicago, they did ultimately push through a consent decree, although the Justice Department under Jeff Sessions attempted to stop the process unsuccessfully. In Chicago, they did stop it. What's happened there is the state attorney general has stepped in and is sort of carrying that process forward.
Were these people who were held, the 700 between 2012 and 2014, were they disproportionately minority?
Yes, the people that I talked to, this is not documented in the report, I think in part because the record keeping was quite spotty at the police department and sheriff's office. Ville Platte is about two-thirds black, and most of the people who were held were from Ville Platte. What I was told is a disproportionate number of the people held were black.
What do you see happening moving forward?
From the people that I've spoken to who've looked at the agreements and people locally in Ville Platte, including current former law enforcement locally, I think there's a real pessimism that these agreements will really have any significant effect, in part because they involve sort of distant oversight from Washington. There's no local monitor. And in addition, there's no federal judge to make sure people are the local law enforcement is doing what they agreed to in that agreement. So, as the chief told Neil Artigue told the Advocate newspaper shortly after the agreements, he said, I'm paraphrasing slightly, but you know, we're almost there. It's just a few more pieces of paper, and that ultimately, without the backing of a judge and the ability to really enforce the agreement in a serious way may be all that those agreements are.
And in one case, a 12-year-old boy was apprehended. Is that correct?
Yes, this is Bobby Lewis. This is in December of 2016. He and some friends had been taking shelter from the rain under a carport. Somebody, it turned out to be one of his friends, not him, threw a rock through an abandoned building. There are lots of them in Ville Platte. Broke the window, and the police were called. Later that morning, one of the detectives from the Ville Platte Police Department, Jessica Laborde, who goes by Scrappy, picked Bobby up along the side of the road and brought him into the station and held him there for a time and began interrogating him. And as he tells it, in quite explicit language, his mother backs that up. She eventually showed up, but initially the interrogation was without a lawyer or a parent present, and went quite beyond the rock throwing. It also involved allegations of all sorts of other quite serious crimes that he had no knowledge of. And I should say, I tried to reach out to the detective, but she did not respond to my inquiries.
Well, thank you for sharing your story. From ProPublica, Ian McDougall, about what's happening in Ville Platte. Not so far from our listening audience. I'm sure some people are actually listening in Ville Platte. I've been through that town and listened to WRKF. Thank you, Ian.
Thank you so much, Jim. I appreciate you having me on.
Take care. Tomorrow, we'll start with the last man to win 30 games in a major league season, Dennis Dale McLean. He won 31 in the year of 1968. Next month will be 50 years since he won his 30th on September 14th, 1968. But he'll be here to remember his former manager. He didn't get along with him, Ted Williams, the Splendid Splinter, one of the great players in the history of Major League Baseball. Tomorrow's the 100th anniversary of the birth of Theodore Samuel Williams, who holds a Major League record in this age of sabermetrics, 482 on-base percentage, meaning more than 48% of the time he was on base in his Major League career. 344 career average. He served heroically both in World War II and Korea, and despite that hit 521 home runs in a 19-year Major League season. But according to those who knew him, Ted Williams was not such a nice guy. We'll talk about it with Denny McLean and much more. Aaron Nola, the Phillies, last night he pitched brilliantly, but did not get the decision as he outpitched Max Scherzer once again. Nola's 15-3, Scherzer's 16-6. And we'll see what happens down the stretch as Aaron Nola, the 25-year-old ace for the Phillies, strives to become the first LSU pitcher to win a Cy Young Award. Until tomorrow, for Matt Doyle, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening to Talk Louisiana, and stay tuned.